time to all of you. This is Lena Life. I'm Lena Mirmont, and I like to introduce my guest, Robert Rideout.
Hello, Lena.
How are you, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm great. Yeah, it's snowy here, but it's winter.
Well, it's quite cold here, but I will look forward to our quite colorful discussion and to introduce you in a brief but hopefully meaningful way. I would say that about people like yourself, most people read in the books or write about, and your life is certainly very rare in very conflicting circumstances.
Yeah.
And hopefully we will turn many pages of your life, and hopefully you will be comfortable enough to share with us some of the spiritually intimate moments, because you certainly touched so many aspects of human experiences. You've been in so many sites that one would just imagine, how did you do it all? And I guess my first question would be, would it be fair estimation on my part to say that in a big picture, your life is divided as a first part before you experienced prison life, and then your second part of your life, which became perhaps that much richer, that much profound, and with much more of unlimited exhibition of your gift as a writer, as a composer, and as a person.
I would say you were totally right on that.
Okay, well, if I'm in something right, please start from every point which has to do with your personal experiences in your first part of your life. What do you remember? And if you can tell us about your childhood, something about your family.
So well, my family was pretty unique. My dad was a doctor, and my mother was General MacArthur's scrub surgery nurse down in New Guinea in World War II. And she was like Lucille Ball, and quite a character. And she and my dad were actually not a good match, and I had a sister named Joyce who spent 23 years with us before she left her body. And that was that's a whole other story, which is in the book. But we grew up in a very dysfunctional household. They were both wanted to be super parents back in the 50s and have us in the super achiever kind of mentality of people back in that era for their children. And I was a total rebel. I mean, I didn't gravitate towards any of the stuff that they wanted me to. And when the Beatles came along, that's what really changed me. Before I even heard the Beatles, I just saw a picture of them from behind and what it looked like to be behind a drum set. And I knew right then that was what I was going to do. I just knew it immediately. And because of the Beatles and all the other bands that came along during that time, I became a musician instantly. And that really blew my parents away, because they were both professional people, doctor and a nurse, and wanted to see me continue in art history and things like that. And it just wasn't to be my path.
We certainly all have different genes in us, and I would say some spiritual genes and some medical genes. Yours are certainly quite complex, and I will make just a little correction to say that you probably been born as a musician. You did discover it, and perhaps, not to be terribly presumptuous, but I would find that your music is somewhat an outlet, and it was an escape from very difficult family environment.
Oh, it totally was. Yeah, music was my first love before I even had a girlfriend. And then that really caused problems with both marriages, too, because of that love for music. And pursuing that lifestyle. Women at first might be attracted to that, and later when you're actually married to a working musician, it's not that great for the woman. You know, they don't want to go to the bars and see you play. And so that was very stressful in that way. But yes, you're right. I was probably born a musician because I had one drum lesson, and the guy said, there's nothing I can show him. He already knows everything. So I just knew how to play right away. And I didn't learn to play guitar until about 25 years later after drums. That came way later in my life. And then the guitar gave me the ability to write songs, too. And I think with my parents, I was born much more spiritual than them. My mother recognized it on her deathbed, totally did. But they thought I was crazy most of my life. And, you know, in a lot of ways I probably was, but I was just following my own drummer, which was what I had to do. And I did it my way, and I took the hard road, as you found out in the book. I mean, the real hard road.
Yes, and you certainly did. And let me just interject something. We all, at some point, feel that we're in prison. We all feel trapped. There is no exception in anybody's life, no matter how wealthy or poor one been born to, or whether he or she felt more or less open to life. That
right.
just seems to be an experience. Now, your situation was, in one sense, an illustration of this very challenging human road with so many curves. May I ask you, when did you feel in your teens that you are having this life dilemma, which way to go, which music I like to compose, where do you find yourself the most, with the most of frustration? Is it like an event, or it's your own searching?
Gosh, in my teens, you know, I was like an underdog at school. I didn't fit in with any group. I always felt alone. I was very intelligent, but I was just one of these kids that would champion the underdogs. So when music came, that became my whole identity. I was the only musician in my class, and I had a pretty large graduating class. And then I kept doing it. And I'm not quite sure how to answer your question, if that sheds any light on what you were asking. Or
it really is, because, frankly speaking, this idea of concrete and abstract couldn't be more revealing in your answer, because very often we're looking for the solution, we're looking for certain calming pain remedy, and we're looking for something to see it. We all prompt, naturally so, to get rid of pain as quickly as we can, but
right.
It just happened this way. So you found, you know, this. Yes,
yet. Yeah. Well, when you live in the world of music as a professional musician, you kind of live in a beautiful world. I mean, it's a lot of work. But the actual fact of creating something with other musicians that people enjoy and dance to, and you can make money doing it and actually have a job doing it, or you could back during the years I did it. It's all changed now. But it was like a beautiful world to live in, and a total escape from reality of regular jobs.
And you just ended my thought, because you found your piece, perhaps a little simplification, but you found your metronome of life in a very abstract form of it, because nothing could be more abstract and yet more powerful than anything in the world as music. And that brings another question. You probably felt so deeply conflicting, because in one end you experienced the most height of anybody's emotional reward being with your music, and yet in the real life you probably had such a tremendously powerful frustration. They
were
just as powerful as music, but just a different aspect of it.
So yeah.
tell me a little bit how those two you can match, how one
Well, I had a lot of guilt, really, because of my parents' pressure of, you know, and you didn't even study music, my dad would go. You just do it. And I said, well, if you can just do it, why do I have to study it? You know, I just knew how to get there without having to read a map or any of that kind of stuff. I just played by ear my whole life. And that really got on my dad's nerves, that if you're going to be a musician, be a musician. Well, I never really took the time or had a chance to study it because I was always working. From when I was 18, for the next 28 years, I played 4 to 6 nights a week, or sometimes 2 nights. But most of my life was filled with playing music in bars. And then you're in a total enabling environment for alcohol, drugs, women, everything that comes with the lifestyle. That's the kind of world I worked in, heaven and hell. On one level, and hell, definitely.
And the conflict is right there, which we've been talking about, because you're touching heaven with music and your own just unbelievable identity in such a fantastic, abstract way, and yet you see the most difficult, sometimes ugly side of life. This is quite a combination.
Well, then as I got older, it even got harder because drum machines came along and were putting a lot of drummers out of work. And I thought, my God, do I even have a career anymore? I mean, those kind of fears really got into me. And I didn't know really what I was going to do because I had placed all my eggs in one basket, so to speak, the music basket. And job skill-wise, that's when I had to start learning how to do other kinds of work to stay alive. And I've done so many kinds of work now. I'm a jack of all trades on many levels, from carpentry to electricity to just everything, years of landscaping and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, so, you brought electricity from your music to real craft of electricity in life. I guess you found your own bridge, thankfully. Robert, I will ask you a question straight, but please choose to answer it the way you feel comfortable.
Okay.
You talk about your life in prison. I mentioned before that at some point we're all experiencing our internal prison.
Yeah, we're all doing time.
We all do certain things, correct. Tell me about life in prison.
In retrospect, it was probably the greatest blessing in my life. And I know that just sounds totally mind-blowing. But when I look at it now, 5 years, almost 6 years later, prison was what I needed. I was so close to dying that, and my death urge was so strong. That's why the alcohol, I was drinking like, don't tell me to stop drinking. I want to drink and just black out and not wake up. I was so depressed. And when I got the DUI that put me into prison, then the fear came, an intense fear. I mean, when you're sentenced, the lawyer said, you're not going to jail. You're going to start in jail, but you're going to prison. So you've got to get your life together in about 1 month. Well, that's when I thought I was going to die. I had never felt so low or so afraid in my life. Every picture of prison goes through your mind, and you think you're going to be killed or raped or whatever. And then when it actually happened, as soon as I signed the plea bargain and they handcuff you, then it was a sigh of relief. I could just let go and think, okay, now this has actually begun, because it was the fear of living for a month before prison was worse than the actual reality of prison.
Because of unknown, probably, correct?
Pardon?
Because it's unknown. It's something you...
Yeah, the fear of the unknown. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And everybody's idea of prison is like where you don't want to go. And this wasn't as bad as you would think, because it was everybody in my prison was in for DUIs, so they're all alcoholics, and they're all very dysfunctional with short attention spans. But it didn't quite have the fear level of the real prisons, the real yards. But we got a lot of inmates from those real yards that came to our prison as their numbers got lowered. They put them in a minimum security prison with us. Then they want to create more fear and more politics. So you're constantly living in fear in prison. Every day you're on edge. And it's like Survivor on TV. You're around people 24/7, and I was around them for 25 months. You're never alone. There's eyes watching you all the time. And there's somebody sleeping right next to you or above you. so you're continually around people. And for people that, it's just strange to be in an environment like that. It's like a pressure cooker of humanity. And it's the same kind of stuff goes on in the inside as on the outside, but it's more magnified. So you really get to see who you are and how you react to people, because it's almost like everybody's naked because we're all wearing the same color, orange. These orange T-shirts and pajama bottoms that you'll wear the whole time. So you don't really know who anybody is from their external clothes like we do on the outside world, or
yes,
the judgments that are formed.
Yes, I have to jump in because I like to keep certain sure. flow of my questions, because your life is certainly enough offering of interest and curiosity. So forgive me if I'm interrupting.
No, go ahead, Lena.
This is another issue you brought, which I found extremely challenging, that you never alone, but you probably felt quite lonely never being alone until you felt this perhaps transformation and finding certain connections with yourself.
Yeah.
So how did you find your prison time not only provoke your connections to yourself, but what type of connections do you feel you made with yourself?
The greatest blessing in prison was the Course in Miracles came back to me. I had read it and practiced it for a year, about 20 years prior to prison, and thought I really wasn't ready yet. And then I happened to find it and got it sent to me into prison, where I had the time to read the whole thing, do all the lessons again, and really, really concentrate on it and meditate on it and use everybody in prison for what the Course in Miracles is trying to teach you, to really change your perception. And it worked. It really worked. And in fact, I was almost afraid to leave prison because I felt so close to God in prison towards the end that when I left, I was like totally reborn. And the biggest part was one day in prison, I really forgave myself for all of the guilt and shame of six DUIs and what I had done to end up in prison, and what I had done to my son, to my ex-wives, to all my friends. Everybody was so afraid I was going to die. I mean, I hurt so many people on so many levels. And they all forgave me, but the hardest part was forgiving myself. And when that finally happened, then I just felt an elation. I just felt free. And then I was told in prison, don't go around with a smile on your face. That people don't want to see a free, happy person in prison. But that's how I felt. And I wanted to help others to wake up, to see that they put themselves there, the judges and the police and all that. They aren't to blame. You're to blame. I really had to get that I was to blame for everything in my life, everything. I had done it. I had done it so that I would slowly know who I really was.
Okay, let me interfere with this comment. This is certainly a process, and in your situation, it happened to be in prison, in somebody's S situation, it can be some kind of one-time shocking experience.
Right.
So we're all maturing through fear, and a fear becomes extremely strong motivating factor, which starts from forcing us to think, to feel, to open our mind. That fear factor is just most powerful if, and I will stress this, if it finally leads one in the right direction. In your case, it certainly did. So I would ask you, when you felt that you forgave yourself, since you clarified it with such a distinct emotional realization, I will ask a personal question. I have difficulties with the forgiveness, and I know that in our country, situation with the forgiveness creates a lot of controversial reactions. Often people are trying to forgive the criminal who killed the member of their family.
Right.
And this dimension of forgiveness is extremely complex. And sometimes I feel that people saying those things, but by their instinct and by their extremely unerasable pain, they cannot forgive. Because after all, how can you forgive someone who took a life of someone you treasure and someone who was a member of your family. So let me ask you about this forgiveness. In your situation, not only it worked so well for you, but it did work in some other vision of your world. So let me go after prison life, and you already touch upon this, predicting my another question, that indeed that was quite a change. It's almost like a rebirth, like a revolution.
Oh, it was a rebirth, yeah.
To see a free world again, because it's not so easy sometimes to deal with freedom. Tell a little bit about your life after prison, and then we will talk a little bit more about your artistry, and certainly we'll listen to one of your songs. So let's go after prison, your second phase.
Okay, I had to start with baby steps because I couldn't drive or even get a license for the next year. And then when I could get a license, I had to have the interlock breathalyzer thing on it that you have to breathe in to start your car so there's no alcohol in you. And I didn't have any money. My friends picked me up and drove me back up to Washington State from Arizona and put me in their house. And when I saw how beautiful their house was, they had built it when I was in prison. And it's a mansion in the woods. And they go, here's your own bedroom and here's your own bathroom. And after prison, that was just, I just stood there and almost wanted to cry. I couldn't even believe I'd have my own bathroom, let alone my own bedroom, in the woods, totally. A beautiful place. And then I slowly started to get work. And when I got my first $5 paid, I looked at that like I'd never even seen $5 again, or before. And here, it was in my late 50s when I got out of prison. So it really was just like being a baby again and totally starting over. And I didn't want to take anything for granted because I know the rug can be pulled out from under you at any time. And that happened before when my house burned down, which we didn't talk about, but I lost everything I owned basically then. And then I lost it all again in divorce. So, and then prison, I lost everything. And I was worried about the few possessions I had when I got out, if they were in the mini storage and the rent had been paid. And I was missing a few things, but I basically got, you know, the pictures and the things that meant the most to me were there. So I didn't have much, but I stayed with my friends. Then we built me a little apartment above their cabinet shop, so I finally had my own little place for a while. Then I went on to live with a roommate for about a year, and that was hard because his manners, the way I had been institutionalized in prison, you know, you got to be totally clean all the time and respectful of the other person. Respect is the one big lesson you learn in prison, and every prisoner will tell you that, and that's with a capital R. And it's just respect for everything, respect for life, respect for how people do things. And my roommate and I, we conflicted. He's a good guy, but you know, some of the little things he'd do, boy, he would have been beat up in prison. So that was a little hard, and I didn't really want to confront him with it. I just didn't want to make waves. So I just kind of let it brew inside me and held resentments against him, which wasn't good. Then a miracle happened, and I got my own place. These people in the book called the Guardian Angels, they did their magic and had been watching me for a couple years after I got out of prison, how I was finally got employed and this and that, and wanted my own place. And they found me a farm that looks at the whole town of Colville, Washington, where I live. It's totally affordable rent in a beautiful setting with woods and pasture and cows and eagles and hawks and wild turkeys and deer, and a perfect home for my three cats. So I'm just where I want to be now. I mean, I can't believe the miracles that have happened to me. And then writing the book, I never really intended to write a book. I just wanted to write the original story with all the real names, and there's quite a bit more. I cut a lot out, and it's still 400 pages, but could have been 800. I just wanted to do that for my son. And then one thing led to another, and it finally ended up being a book. And now I've got a second book of poetry, and I've got a CD coming too. So God has been with me. It's like when I came out, it's my higher self. I finally knew who I really was and was a lot more comfortable with that. And I'm still learning more and more daily who I really am. Of course, I think we all do continually. But I love myself now. Instead of, I'm not at war with myself anymore.
Robert, I'm sorry. I have to jump in because we like to hear as explicit answers as we can, but I like to feed so many other questions. So
sure, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I will cut you off because
I like to
emphasize certain critical issues in your life.
Yeah.
I want to comment. Yes, it is great to feel that God on your side. But those people who literally took you from prison, who are these people? Why they been such incredible friends to you? Instant family, you gain your stability because of them. Again, I'm very much curious to know who these people were for you.
They were my neighbors 10 years before I went to prison. We were neighbors for about 8 or 9 years over on the western side of Washington State, living way up in the woods on battery-powered houses. And that's where my house burned down, and they were my immediate neighbors. So we have been best friends since 1983.
So you're still close with them?
Oh, yes. They are my family.
Your family.
Yeah. They are totally my family, yeah.
There are two issues which I like to absolutely take in great details. It's your relationship with your son, and also I'd like to ask you, going just for a moment to your prison time, did you have any friends there? Do you still have any connection as a free man with your prison time?
No. Yes, I did have friends. Well, I had one friend there that I would. And that was my bunkie. That's the guy in the book, that Larkins, that I tell everything to. And I got a hold of him after I got out of prison, and he went back to drinking again. And that's the last time we spoke, and now I've tried on the computer to find him, and I don't seem to be able to find the right person, because I'd like to send him a copy of the book, because he was always laughing at me, saying, you're never going to get your book published. Well, he's in it. And most everything about him is pretty much kind of like he was. So, but prisoners do not stay in touch. Almost all of them. You always say to people, "Yeah, I'll write you," or this and that. But it just doesn't happen. And it really does. People don't want to go back there. They don't want to remember that.
Can imagine the reason I asked that question because, in one sense, obviously, denial is a very negative thing, but our real life, no matter how difficult or painful that is or that was, it's our life, and it's part of our memory, our baggage, and we're carrying this with us no matter where we are. It's something which I personally would say have a bit of a question with expression. It says something, not only move forward, but it says snap out of it and move forward.
Yeah.
It's not such an easy thing to do. I believe that, I believe more in evolution. I believe more that you cannot really snap out of it because we're not robots. We are human beings. And the reason I ask you about your connection with the prison, because I personally feel that you always will have these connections in the back of your mind, but it will create extremely powerful strengthening your human nature memories. I think it makes your music that much richer because your emotional world is that much more diversified because you went through such extreme of emotions and physical experiences.
Oh, yeah. And I think India prepared me for prison, unbeknownst to me, till I kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together. But, I mean, India was just as heavy as prison in a different way, where you have to learn patience and things like that. And prison is the same way. So because I'd been to India, I think I had an easier time adjusting to prison than a lot of inmates did. Because India's crowded. You're around people all the time, too. And it was similar but different. You asked about my son earlier.
Yes,
We will
talk about your son in great details, but I just wanted to interject something which is in my mind as a parallel. in Eastern Europe, especially before collapse of Soviet Union, communal living was extremely popular, and the number of very distinguished families will share the same bathroom, the same kitchen, and many people would be lucky just to be in the center of a city and have a room of their own. But many people just had to share everything.
Yeah.
So for someone, yes, it was somewhat a bit of a claustrophobic feeling, some emotional prison. Needless to say, the totalitarian regime is prison right there. So just to make a little parallel, how much human can take, how much human can develop and then prosper from the experiences. And that's what I think brought to your revelation in a relationship with your son. Please tell us about it.
Oh, my son is doing fantastic. He read the whole book, and I got nothing but kudos from him. It touched him very deeply, of course, because I wrote it for him. And there were a few parts in it he didn't really know till he read them, how much I was drinking before I went to prison. And so now kind of some of the pieces of his puzzle fit together when he thinks back on it. But he's forgiven me totally, and he's so proud of me that it's just incredible. And we've had time together. He lives in Arizona, and he's been married now for 2 years, and he works for the USGS, and he's in his third year of college in Flagstaff, a straight-A honor student. My son is the exact opposite of me as far as he's not of hippie mind whatsoever. He's more like a geek computer guy. But he is very, very deeply spiritual and has been ever since he was born. We saw that right from the get-go with him. And he's been raised in a highly spiritual path through his mother and his stepfather who passed on. So he's got a very great connection to God and a spiritual path his whole life. He's just been raised that way since he was little. And it's really worked for him. He's very happy. I just couldn't ask for all of my prayers seem to be answered, you know, you can read about in the book, and all the estrangement from my son for so many years. And now it's just, we are very tight. You know, we talk on the phone and email and try to get together like every year, whether I have to go down there or they can come up here. But, and in the future, when they give me a grandchild, which will probably happen, we've already talked about it, I think I'm going to be probably moving to where they live, so that as I get older, I can be a big part of their life.
Go ahead.
Well, the little boy that I lost in him, maybe I can get that back by being a grandparent to a grandchild, you know,
yes,
to my own grandchild, and that would just be like incredible.
Yeah, we. Catching up with grandchildren, I don't have yet my own, but I imagine this is somewhat very wonderful, typical progression. I will certainly welcome your music in a few seconds. What about your Christmas? How are you going to see?
My Christmas?
Yes.
I'm actually having Christmas alone, and that really doesn't bother me because my sister and my mother both died in December. So December's always been kind of a heavy month for me, although it doesn't feel that way anymore, but it used to. And I've had so many Christmases alone or in prison or whatever that I'm unattached to having to be with other people at Christmas or anything like that. My good friends that picked me up from prison and we just talked about, I usually have it with them, but this year they're going over to the coast to be with his mother. So I'm just going to be alone and just enjoy it.
Well, after this Christmas confession of yours, we're going to listen to your song. And then after this, you will tell us about it and what particularly prompted me to choose this song. Is your just quite a gifted melodic and harmonic internal hearing and internal imagination, how music can be connected through melody, harmony, and words. So let's hear your song, which called She's There.
Okay.
And then we will continue our
interview. Just let me interject before you play it that This song isn't completely done yet, but my son's going to put a saxophone solo in it, and the lead guitar is not on it yet. So what you're hearing is about 80% of the song, but you'll get the idea anyway on both songs.
And before you wanted to interject this, I have to tell our listeners that this is music by Robert Rideout, who is my guest for today's very unusual interview with his life, with his changes in quite dramatic way.
Should also say that the name of the book is Still Singing Somehow.
I just was going to say this, that correlation between your singing and your writing and your thinking is very much the same, because it is still singing, no matter which way and form you choose to express this. So
Right. Let
us, we heard you speak, now we're going to hear you sing. This is a Robert Rideout song, which called She's There.
Romantic to hopelessly alone, I can't find nobody to call my home. I've been adrift on the sea like a long lost soul a long time, but I still believe somebody is out there. You see, she's waiting and searching for somebody like me, but the timing isn't right yet for her to come along. But she's there in the back of my head all the time, and someday the lady will be mine. But for now I just pray all of my mind love to come back into my life. It's hard to keep flying with no wind in your sails, and this dream is kind of like that when doubts prevail. But the need for love within me, just won't die. So I keep on believing day and night, that each moment passing will bring her into sight, and this dream will be over finally for the rest of my life. But she's there in the back of my head all the time, and someday the lady will be mine. But for now, I just pray with all of my might for true love to come back into my life. 'Cause I know she's there. Come back into my heart.
hopelessly romantic, to hopelessly alone. I can't find nobody to call my own. I've been adrift on the sea like a long lost soul a long time. But I still believe somebody is out there to see. She's searching and waiting for somebody like me. But the timing isn't right yet for her to come along. But God, I know she's there. In the back of my head all the time. And someday the baby will be mine. But for now, I just pray with all of my mind for true love. Come back into my life, 'cause I know she's there. Oh, she's there. No, she's there.
Robert, this is such a beautiful expression, not because I'm having an interview with you, but I tell you frankly that your sadness, which expressed in this song, so eloquent. It's not a pessimistic sadness. It's a very much of a human sadness. And many people can find and will find comfort and dialogue with their sadness and the sadness which you expressed. It's not such a simple thing to do. I just want to ask you, how do you compose? Do you hear music inside of yourself, then you write it, or you just play it? What is the birth of your music?
I usually come up with the words first, and then I just start playing around with chords.
Uh-huh. You know,
I've got a tickle in my throat, and I got to cough. Just a minute.
Take your time. So I, okay. I know you told me you had some cold. It's unfortunately proper season to have colds for all of us. Coming back to your music, so you said that you will certainly orchestrate this. You will add a few other instruments. I also wanted to ask you, is that something genre of country songs? How would you categorize that?
God, I kind of think of it more like Tom Waits, kind of like his style. Not really country. The next one you're going to play is a little bit more country.
I see.
And I've been influenced a lot by, like, Jimmy Buffett, Willie Nelson, George Harrison. Those are probably my three biggest musical influences.
Okay.
So, go ahead and play the next one, and you'll see a whole different kind of song.
Yes, I certainly will do this, but let me make this suggestion. See if you're comfortable with this. Our time is coming to the end, and because you have this little voice restriction, and we certainly will not ask you to sing live at this program, but I will be very happy to play you another song, after which we will just briefly conclude with a couple of questions which I will ask you to think about while we've been listening to your second song. Firstly, I wanted to know if you planning to expand your music activities and to perform with some other singers. If you plan, I don't know, your financial, so to speak, backup system. Musicians usually, unfortunately, short on funds. But I'd like to know how you plan to do this. And my last question would be, how do you see the world today through your own eyes? So I will leave you with a little bit of a rest for your throat.
Okay.
With those thoughts. And it will be my pleasure to introduce another song by Robert Rideout, who is my guest and who is sharing his life with us. So here's his song.
Another hour, another day, I'll make it through it any way I can. Somehow, another moment just now passed, forever gone, nothing lasts I see. Somehow, somehow I stumble through the darkness towards the light. Doing it all again this time, but trying to get it right. Somehow, another year just now passed. Here comes another. Will it last any longer? Somehow. So on we go, round and round. Another moment just went down right now. Somehow. Somehow I've made it this far, living day to day, enjoying each moment of my life, all along the way. Somehow, another hour, another day, I make it through it any way I can. Somehow, yeah, somehow, somehow, oh, somehow.
Another certain is such a beautiful, with just a wonderful human sensitivity melody. I like to ask you these two questions about your music plans, and yeah, also like to have enough time to see your vision of today's world.
Okay, on the music end, I've got there's a lot of musician friends that live in my community here, or a small number anyway, and they're helping me on this CD. I'm going to add a couple, two or three female vocalists to the first song you heard, like background vocals, so we'll do answer backs to She's There. And if I promote this CD locally around here, I'm pretty much a one-man act. From having been in bands for so many years, I prefer to just be alone, because I don't have to practice with other people and all that kind of stuff that comes with it. I just go and do it, and I can just do it fine just by myself. So I really kind of like being a solo act. But if the CD ever took off, yeah, it would be nice to have some friends join me and have a small little three or four piece band that could back up all 12 songs that are on the CD. And I've got a lot more. I really have enough for a couple CDs, but I just picked 12 of the very best for this upcoming CD, which is the same title as the book, Still Singing Somehow. And it'll be out probably in February, and it will be on Amazon. All this stuff is on my website, stillsingingsomehow.com. You can see all the pictures out of the book and the reviews and the interviews that this current interview we're doing now. If you send me an MP3, it will be on my website. So yes, we'll have that there too.
At the end of the program, I certainly wanted you to announce your all these announcements and information about your music, about your book, and all of this. I'd like you to repeat again at the very end of our program. And because this time almost up, I like to conclude with my final question about your vision of our modern world through your own eyes, through your own thoughts.
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question. I have faith you know, it all depends on faith. It all comes down to faith. And I know we're going through a crisis in this world, and I really believe that in the future here, everybody is going to change inside, that slowly we're all getting more light in our DNA, or however you want to talk about it on the cosmic terms, but we're all waking up. And some of us are waking up faster than others, and nobody gets out of this thing without helping everybody else, the way I kind of see it. So whatever the weird weather and all the unemployment and everything is happening all over the world, and especially our country too, and I'm part of it too, I just keep my faith that there is a God, and everything works for a purpose and a reason, that we do not know the whole story by any means. Everybody and everything is so interconnected, it's incredible. I know it is, and from personal experience. So I just always keep my faith, and every time I have been despondent, boy, oh boy, when I pray that, or whatever, that the next day I'm employed again, or the answers come, or you just have to relax more and watch it happen. You know, don't live in fear. You know, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. And really, fear is, bottom line, is that we have a fear of God. And God never judges us. When people pray to God to be forgiven, you don't need to, because he never judges you. You have to forgive yourself. So it all really comes down to you. So each one of us has to find that faith within ourselves to enjoy each moment, because life is so precious, and you don't want to end up with a house burning down or in prison like I did. Just count your blessings. Count your blessings for your health, for everything you've got in your life, especially your friends. There's nothing greater in life than friends. That's what I found. So I have a lot of faith that in the future still.
I certainly will express one little regret that I had to jump in, because I wanted to literally fit some most important, or at least a good part of important points of your life. So I hope you would not judge very strongly this interview, because it was my intention. Also, it is that much harder to feel on the moment, because you have whole life ahead of you, when you had already enormously huge experiences behind of you. So I was trying to keep this in mind and orchestrate this interview, even though totally spontaneously, but I also wanted to make sure that you felt enough comfortable to touch on the most important, at least some very profound experiences which you had. I'd like to wish you continue to be on your road, continue to share your story with others. Certainly, if you have opportunity to be part of some young children who are sometimes troubled more than they deserve to be, and share experience in a human and creative way, which you just did in this interview, for which I thank you with all my listeners. And I will wish you wonderful holiday time. And if you're alone, you're definitely not lonely. So I wish you continue your faith.
No, you're never alone.
Never alone.
Never alone.
So success and prosperity in the new year. So
well, thank you so much, Lena.
It's my pleasure to, again, tell your name and give you an opportunity to announce your website, the name of your book, and a couple of CDs, which people can purchase from Amazon.com. And then after this, we will say goodbye to you, and we will continue with our program.
Okay, thank you. My name is Rob Rideout, and the book is Still Singing Somehow. And the second book that is very small, the poetry book, which is based on my song lyrics, and it's only $5.99. It's called Still Singing Somehow, The Songs. And these both can be purchased. I'd prefer that you didn't go to Amazon, that you go to my website, which is stillsingingsomehow.com. And Everything can be seen there, viewed there. It's a great website. It takes a minute for it to come up because there's a lot of stuff on it. But bear through that, and you're in for a real treat, especially with the pictures. And if you've read the book, the website will really make a lot of sense. And both books are available there, and the CD will be available there when it comes out, and I'm predicting probably February for the CD, and it will also be called Still Singing somehow.
Well,
so thank you, Lena.
Thank you for this information. It was very clear. Again, with my warmest wishes, I will send you to get better with your cold. And
yeah.
On this note, I will continue with my program after a little pause with another composer who composes for my program, Julian Lampert. And after his beautiful composition, I will have few post thoughts. My last interview before Christmas, and I just wanted to express a few post thoughts. Just less than a week ago, I had an interview with very talented, charming 10-year-old boy whose life was ahead of him, still is, and always will be. He's only 10. But his ocean of talents and maturity was so charmingly overwhelming. He brought so much joy just in 1 hour of speaking to myself, to all of us. Today we had quite a different interview with a person whose life was already quite behind of him, with so many events that it is enough of maturity for him to care through his future life. And dramatic events which took place in the life of Robert Rideout, certainly, unfortunately, not too rare in our lifetime. But it is not very often when a person can so openly talk about him or herself, about the tragedies, and about conquering those tragedies. I was very privileged to have a few other interviews where was just an incredible exhibition of human courage and human wisdom. We always feel how unlimited human way is, and we're always so grateful to our connections, which we're building to other human beings through the course of our life. I would say that my best dream is for the new year, is to develop more of those connections, to be more connected on every level, not to be afraid of those connections, and find not necessarily a long period of time, but just a moment of connection. Moment, not only a smile, not to be afraid to cry a little bit, but just to be connected then we never will be lonely. Many people say, don't say never. I would be that cautiously, but arrogant, and say that in this case, no connections is too short. And if we will find those moments of connections, we indeed never will be lonely. Because if one connection didn't work, other one will. I guess this is so much for the faith. That was your Lena Life. I'm Lena Mirmont, with my warmest wishes for a wonderful Christmas to BBS, to all of you. I will think I will see you still in this year, next week, with all my best thoughts. Thank you for all your listening, your thoughts, and your wishes to each other. Goodbye.